Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past. This series of podcasts were culled from sessions held during the 2019 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference, held at the Parramatta campus of Western Sydney University on the 26th and 27th of October, 2019. The podcasts were made from live microphone feeds. This session was titled, It's Academic, The Value of Writing Degrees. Creative writing postgraduate degrees have become increasingly popular in the last decade. Associate Professor Sarah Knox from Western Sydney University talks to Dr. Jessie Blackadder, Dr. Rachel LeRossignol, and PhD candidate Joshua Mostova about the benefits of combining the process of completing a novel with a deeper examination of the genre's purpose, themes, and interpretation of research. Associate Professor Sarah Knox began by asking, what does it mean to have the academic approach to writing a novel? Dr. Jessie Blackadder responded.
When I came into my doctorate to do my research around the first women to go to Antarctica, I would say I was a very naive academic. I was not, my master's degree had been a coursework master, so I came in without a lot of research, academic research background. And so for me, coming in with no training in history, no formal education in history, no formal training in research, it offered me a huge amount because it actually gave me a grounding in, you know, even just where you go and find stuff, the sort of things. So as well as researching who were these women, where did they go, what did they do, which is probably where I would have stopped. That would have been the total of my research if I hadn't come in and done it in a degree. But what I then ended up researching was how are stories told about Antarctica? What is actually the nature of stories that are told? Why is it so gendered? That was something I was interested in. Why is there, more than any other place I could think of, this narrative of the grand, masculine, heroic journey where your feet had to fall off or you had to be eaten by huskies or something? and then women's stories did not stand up to that. So for me, it gave a whole other level to the research and a whole level of thinking about the story I was telling that was very different to the approach I'd had in researching my Scottish novel.
Okay. Well, we'll come back to some of that, but let's have a go with Rachel.
Yep. So I actually, with my PhD, I was looking at the cultural stories around climate change. So my creative piece was a young adult novel about a teenage girl with Asperger's who starts changing the community story around climate change. Ironically, I was told by my examiner that my work was totally naive.
Could never happen.
I think my time has come now. My background, my first degree, my bachelor degree was actually in social work. So the stories that we tell and the power of the stories that we tell and how they shape the way that we think in our psychology was very much part of what I was bringing into it. So I actually, in writing my thesis part, I was actually using a social work methodology, a counselling methodology, which is narrative therapy. So I was looking at what are our current narratives and how can we change them to tell stories that empower us and allow us to be more effective in dealing with climate change. Again, told by a male academic that I was naive to think this might be a thing. But he also, I was also writing about, like as part of that, I was writing about ecofeminism. And he said I should have written more about male enlightenment thinkers. So, you know, I think he might have missed the mark. But what that meant was that my research process was bringing in a lot of strands. It was bringing in strands from social work and strands from fiction and strands from sort of the media, sort of way nature and is presented. Like I looked at Disney films and, and how, you know, we have to fight nature and, you know, all this sort of stuff. So my research was very sort of far-reaching, and some of it was looking at media and some of it was looking at academic texts. And some of it was looking at social work approaches and social work readings around narrative therapy. So, yeah, so there were a number of different strands, I guess.
Joshua.
So I'm in the middle of doing this research degree. So my impressions are still being formed, and I can't pretend to have such a complete understanding as either of the other two on this panel. But what I've found is that researching different, doing different theoretical work can, depending on what the nature of that work is and what is being investigated, it can either work well with the creative process or not. And so when I was writing a lot about the sort of epistemology, like how we know things about the past, it actually seemed to be working against getting anything written. Because all I was doing was describing the problems. Now that I've moved on to another chapter in the research, which is about how to tell stories, and I think this ties in with what you were saying, Jesse, it dovetails quite nicely, and things that I'm doing in one side of it are helping or informing the other process and vice versa. So
there's kind of a generative aspect to some of the research, and there's a suffocating aspect to other parts of the research.
Yeah. Paralyzing.
Yeah. Paralyzing.
Suffocating, paralyzing. Do you want to add one?
Pressure. No, I can't.
Pressure.
Oh, pressurizing.
Yes. Because the novel thing about doing a creative project, when it's a big creative project, but you're also doing this other thing over here, which is completely different. Mm-hmm. So what does that do? I mean, clearly we're hearing here that it may do something to the capacity to actually write the creative project or to write it smoothly. What does, for instance, that the kinds of writing that you need to do for an exegetical piece of work, an academic piece of work, what's the impact of that on the writing of the fiction, stylistically, for instance?
I think I agree with you, Joshua. It can be that sort of forensic examination of either your own creative material or the creative process when you're right there in the heat of it, when you're really working on it, can be a bit horrifying. And I think many writers have a healthy dose of superstition, whatever the superstition may be. It's quite a personal thing, but you know that I can't talk about it too much, I can't speak about the work to anyone. So when you come into academia with a project and you know you're speaking about it from the first moment or from before you arrive, that takes a shift. And I know for me it's, I do have a bit of a suspicion that if I speak about it too much in too much detail and pin it down too early, that then it will melt away. And I've had that happen. In my master's degree, I wrote this whole essay about the novel that I was writing, and I ended up with quite a nice essay about the novel and a dead novel that never got finished. So I probably approached it with some trepidation, and I was supervised by Gail Jones and Sarah, and Gail strongly suggested to me to write the novel first, and I'm not sure if that was because of her own sort of thoughts around that process, but I did have I did have the novel pretty solidly down before I was doing the reading for the exegetical work, but I had the novel pretty solidly before I went into the horror of the exegesis. That's how it was for me.
And you're not only speaking about it from an early stage, you're also being evaluated on it from an early stage. I've actually written a blog post on this, and I talk about the gaze, the fact that everything you're doing is under the gaze of your faculty and your supervisors. And, like, for me, I won't show anyone a novel that I'm working on until I've done at least three drafts. I think it's not fit for public consumption. No one is going near it. But for your PhD, your supervisors are under a panic to make sure you're producing, you know, because they are under pressure for you to complete by a certain time. And so they want to see, they want to know there's words on the page. So they want to see your first draft. And I was absolutely horrified. I was like, no, you can't see my first draft. No. So there is this real kind of feeling that you're being watched. And then you have to get up there and talk in a room with a bunch of academics. And academics, I'm sorry, academics in the room, but they, you know, they are born cynics and born, you know, you have to question things. That's part of the job. So for someone who's only ever done creative writing before, well, I had done a master's, but to stand up there and have all these people throwing questions at you and challenging you on your ideas when you've only been there a couple of months, like, that is actually terrifying. That, sorry, I'm Miss Doom and Gloom. Like, you guys can be the positive ones. But I think it's important for people who are considering a creative PhD to go in understanding that this is the process, because I didn't know it was the process. And so it was really, like, it really sort of, you know, threw me back a bit to suddenly go, I'm not allowed to just do my process, I have to do their process.
Yeah, look, I'll agree with that.
You go first for the next question.
I think when it came to the confirmation of candidature, which is kind of a milestone in the process where you've done some of it and then everybody kind of looks at what you've done and says, okay, this is working, it's going to go forward or not. I had spent a lot of time working on the sort of theoretical side of it and pretty much none on actually writing any creative work. And Sarah kept telling me, you know, you've got to actually, you know, have something to show at this panel. So I got to the moment, the couple of weeks beforehand, and I churned something out, added it to the end of the document. And when the panel looked at it, they were like, oh, look, this is really considered, you know, the theoretical stuff is, you know, there's some issues with it, but, it, you know, it's going somewhere. That's great. But the creative stuff is not really working. So why don't you, you know, move more sort of, you know, shift the degree more towards the theoretical side of it. And so I kind of then felt I had something to prove. And so and so I thought, okay, I'm going to, you know, publish some other stories and things. And Sarah actually encouraged me to take the time, because I got to the point where I had this manuscript and Sarah mentioned my novella that at the time was just a sort of a messy manuscript, and she encouraged me to sort of take some time out from uni so I could get that finished. And that was a really good move, actually, because after that stage, now I'm coming back to it and feeling much more confident. You know, I've done something. It's not all it's not all one-sided. So yeah. So I would agree with whoever's advice it was to do the creative side first, and maybe I should have, you know, taken Sarah's advice earlier on, but it can be tricky getting too wrapped up in the theoretical stuff. Yeah. So.
But on the other hand, too, when I then did the exegetical work at the end, I also thought, oh, if I'd been thinking about that in this kind of depth, maybe I would have done something different. So I could see I wouldn't want to be too absolutist about it either, because I could also see the benefit of having had some of that more intensive reflection and analysis during it. I don't know, maybe it's good to kind of get a first draft and then do the exegetical work or something, some kind of weird mix of it. But
I mean, we were told as part of our process that it was supposed to be very iterative, that you do the research-led practice and then you do the practice-led research and then you do... And so you're sort of spiralling between the two. But what I found, and I guess what a lot of my cohort found, was that you needed to keep them very separate. You might be doing the creative bit for a while and then you would do the academic, but you couldn't do them both at the same time because they were very different mindsets, and it didn't work to try and jump from that mindset in the morning to that mindset in the afternoon. It just was, you know, you had to separate them out.
It's one endeavour, but it's like doing two jobs.
Yes.
And so you're overworked. Your brain is overworked. But what are the advantages? What are the things that you get when you're doing a creative project? You're writing that novel and you're doing it in academia. What are the novel things about writing the novel in an academic setting?
What scholarship.
Money.
Money. Yes. No. Money.
I basically did it for the scholarship. It sounds awful, but I did. I did it for the scholarship because I had a son on the autism spectrum, and being at work was difficult. And if I was doing a PhD, I could be at home and be available more. Mm-hmm. And when I got the scholarship, I'm like, oh yay! And then when I got to the end of the PhD, and it was like, you're going to graduate now. I'm like, no, I don't want to graduate. I want to keep the scholarship. And then they're like, and we're going to give you a PhD. And I'm like, what? What? Like, I actually get a PhD out of this? I've forgotten about that bit. So yeah, I mean, I did it for other reasons.
That was win-win.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, well, I think with what I'm working on at the moment, the prehistoric stuff, I probably couldn't really do it very effectively, or it would take me immensely much longer time outside of the university for various practical reasons. Access to all the books, you need to read mm-hmm. a lot of books.
Interlibrary
loans, I use that all the time. They must be so sick of me just asking for every book under the sun. And the research funds that allow you to do things, like, there's no way I could have afforded to go. So I went to Bulgaria a couple of months ago and went to an archaeological dig and talked to archaeologists and became in awe of the way they could read the soil. And they just like this patch of, you know, undifferentiated brown, and they say, oh, look at the green bit there, and I'm saying, what green bit? But there's some magic that they do, and they can read the soil and they can see things, and yeah, it's pretty crazy. But that wouldn't have been available to me without being in the university. So and also all the theoretical stuff, I've been a little down on it in what I'm talking about previously, but I think it's actually really necessary to work out some of these knotty questions. Like, often I can't really think about them properly until I've either talked about them at very great length, and I don't really know anyone with a similar obsession with prehistory, so I don't really have anyone to talk to, at least for that amount of time, about that. And so my way of working through those issues is to write them down, and having a framework, like doing a research degree, is, you know, that works really well.
It also gives you a deadline, which you can get through commercial publication when, you know, someone's saying, yes, we want that manuscript, but that's a different kind of a deadline, so you're working to it, and that might help or hinder.
And someone expecting to produce stuff is also very useful.
Yes.
I got a captive librarian.
Ooh.
It was so fantastic. The librarian, so I did mine here, and the librarian was interested in my research subject, and so she just became kind of like my personal helper. And so she would email me sometimes, say, I just found something about the woman you're interested in, or I just found this, or I know this translator who could help you with the Norwegian. And so she became like such an ally in that process. Yeah, she was almost like a research assistant.
Keisha Russell, let's give her a name, because she was such a
No, it wasn't her.
Wasn't it, Keisha?
See, I also lost my memory doing a PhD, so my memory for names is now appalling. I will have to look at it in the back of my book. I can see it. Susan
Robbins.
It was Susan Robbins.
Susan Robbins.
Yeah. Oh, and she was just one. I can still see her face. There was this lovely feeling that you had a cheer squad, and one of the members of the cheer squad is sitting up the back there, Suzanne. And I really remember that feeling of kind of coming into the Writing and Society Centre and having this sense of people that had a delighted interest in what you were doing. How's it going? You know, Suzanne and Melinda were not supervising me, or, you know, didn't have any direct relationship, but they had this sort of collegiate, you know, you're part of this research centre, how's it going? And, you know, I still have the photo of me coming in with the 4,000 billion pages on the day that I handed it in and handing it to Suzanne and, you know, having the photo. The money? But actually the money is an extraordinary thing, because the money says a lot. Yeah. So the money says, this is a legitimate area of inquiry, and we consider it worthy of support.
Yes.
And so that's really nice on a practical level, because the money is great on a practical level, but on some other deeper level, you have this very strong show of support, of somebody saying, this endeavour is of value.
Yes.
And I think you'd take that in. I think as a writer you absorb that. You know, we're such tragic little creatures sometimes, and yes. anything that comes along that gives us value is a great thing. And the mentoring aspect, you know, the privilege of working with wise supervisors. So one of the things that happened to me with Gail was I talked to her about the direction of the novel and the point of view of the novel, and I was very determined to stick closely to historical fact. And in the real historical record, there were three voyages that these women made, and I was going to write all three voyages. And she said, I think you might have a bit of trouble with that. No, I said, no, I won't. It will be great. And I wrote and, you know, she said this all the way through in her lovely, gentle, understated way.
Gail.
You might have a little trouble. No, no, no. And I finished the first voyage, and I thought, this is fantastic. And then the day came for me to sit down and begin to write voyage two, and literally from the first word it was like, oh, no, she was right. I can't. Oh, well, in dramatic terms, I'll be telling the same story three times.
Yeah.
It's just can't be done. Yeah. And also I was writing in the first person, and she really encouraged me to consider writing in the third. And that was the first time in my life that I have not either abandoned a novel or pressed on at all costs to the end of the first draft. And to say, here is somebody giving me really wise advice, and I can take that advice. I could actually stop at this point and change direction. And that was such a great learning for me, that you don't have to press on to the end of the first draft with your idea at all costs if actually it's not right, if it's not working. So I felt like that was an enormous learning I took away.
Mm.
Yeah.
And at the other end of the process, I had one examiner who was not so great, but the second examiner really got my work. And she, the first examiner, the one who said I should write more about male Enlightenment thinkers, his entire comment on my novel, the novel is 70% of your work, and then the exegesis is 30% with the model that I did. And his entire comment on my work, on my novel, was, this is of PhD standard. That's it. That was all the feedback I got from him. And then he screeds and screeds and screeds on the thesis part, all of which was like everything that was wrong with it because it didn't talk about male Enlightenment thinkers. But the other examiner wrote a long, detailed report on my novel, and it was so valuable. You pay $1,000 for a manuscript assessment. I got this for free. Well, the uni paid something, ma'am. So, you know, but I got this marvellous feedback that I could then take and go, well, that is going to help me with turning this into something that I can then take to publishers, you know. And she, my examiner, was an academic and also a published young adult author. So, you know, expertise, as you said, that you're getting there. So, yeah, that was so invaluable.
Can I just add something? I've just had a thought from what you were just saying there about it's sort of the flip side to what you're saying, I guess, because you were saying how having the manuscript read and getting feedback on it helped with, you know, making it sort of publication ready. And but what I find, my experience, is that the project that I'm working on, it might not be something that's commercially. It might just be a thing that, you know, is worth doing in its own right. But then I don't try and publish it because, you know, it's not necessarily something that there's a market for. And when you're in the situation of the university and just trying to do the work for its own sake and just to make it the best it can be, you don't necessarily have to think about this. It can be very helpful, but it also gives you a non-commercial space.
It's a reason in itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, different standard as well. I mean, I've heard a number of publishers say, you know, that a novel that's come out of a thesis is not necessarily going to meet the standard, you know, Australian market. So it would then need work to, you know, to be published.
Well, would that be, do you think, because examiners and supervisors, being academics themselves and possibly creative writers who are doing that harnessed work, which is both aspects of their own sort of intellectual and creative endeavours. I mean, are they looking at very different things, do you think, what editors who have got, editors, publishers are thinking of a niche in a market? So then what does that do when you are writing a version of something where you're doing it under the aegis of a candidacy, doctorate, DCA, whatever, and you're writing it and it says, oh no, you cannot write any longer than 70,000 words. And
somehow I just ignored that bit. I don't know how I squeaked through with 100,000 words, but somehow I managed it, or 90,000 maybe. But I suppose you can think about having a publication document and a candidacy document. that maybe may end up being quite different things, I suppose.
Yeah, and a number of people I know have done that. They've reworked it, or they've taken them in two different directions. Yeah.
I think so. I mean, I think quite a lot of people go through the various PhD or Doctor of Creative Arts programs, and it can be a pathway to your first novel, absolutely. There were certainly people in my course, and I was one of those who had a publication already had published work before, but there were plenty that hadn't, and quite a lot of them did.
A lot of the students who come through Writing and Society do have and got their work published, that piece of work, in one incarnation or another.
Mm.
So it is a way through, I think, to getting a publication outcome. But in the end, you're still thrown upon the resources of the market and whatever genre you're writing it in.
I think for me it was an important step in considering myself to be a professional. So, like a professional writer, going, this is actually my job. So I think that's a worthwhile part of the process as well.
Mm.
Look, I think, I mean, just to bring it back to historical novels, because that's where we're sitting at the moment, I came into the program to write a historical novel, and it was, in terms of the motivation, it was the same as the previous historical novel, which was I got that crazy historical novelist obsession that, I've got to tell this story. You turn into a weird person, but the drive is the same. And the academic pathway is a really great way to do it, with much more support than most of us would normally have to do the in-depth research. But I think the drive is the same, just speaking from writing a historical novel point of view.
Yeah. So could it be said that then doing an academic project which involves a historical novel, doing historical fiction fits better with that than perhaps other genres might? Just because of that whole burden of research that's inbuilt to writing historical fiction.
That was certainly true for me, that it fitted really well within that. And in fact, part of my exegesis was documenting the historical discovery that I had made during my research, which, was a tiny little blip, but personally satisfying. Yeah.
One of the things that people traditionally come into academia to do is to come out of whatever academic postgraduate course they're doing and then go into academia as work, rather than, because you can think the trajectory of a novelist in the market and the trajectory of the, why am I going to
It's the other way around, isn't it? The novelist in
no,
the market.
Actually, I'll stick with that.
Is
it? I mean, why do you do it? Would one do it in order to become, say, a teacher of creative writing, or possibly an academic?
Look, absolutely. And there was one person in my cohort who I felt that he had quite a different mindset and a different approach. I think many of us had come in with a novel idea and then constructed our academic program around it, whereas he had a very fine academic mind. And I remember being at Varuna with him, a group of us went to Varuna to work on our exegetical works together, and it's like, yeah, you actually have that academic pathway because you have that beautiful mind that thrives in that area. And I could see for him, we talked about, he said, you should change into a PhD program rather than the Doctor of Creative Arts, because actually your future is in this world.
Because the emphasis with a PhD is on the exegetical component, even if it's a creative mixed thing, whereas the emphasis with a doctorate of creative arts, at this institution anyway, is on the creative piece.
But I've just started teaching at university this year, which is, you know, having finished my doctorate, when was it, Suzanne? It was a while ago now, but 2014 I think I finished. That was never part of my motivation to do it, but quite, rather to my surprise, I've gone into teaching creative writing and really loved it. Yeah. I'm just doing it casually, but I'm finding it, you know, really enjoyable.
Yes.
What proportion of creative writing
students
do get funded?
Yes. More people doing it unfunded. The metrics are pretty cruel in terms of ranking who might get money, and a lot of it is dependent on previous undergraduate honours, master's level success. So, yes, we have more people who are with us who aren't on scholarships than that.
And if you're part-time, like me, then you can't get a scholarship at all.
So. Right.
You've all spoken mostly really positively about your PhD journeys. I'm just wondering, what's the negative? What's the downside? Were there people in your cohort who didn't have that experience, and who shouldn't do a PhD, I guess is what I'm asking.
Yeah.
I've clearly covered up very well, because I actually had quite a negative experience with mine. We sign a thing that we're never going to talk about that. No, I'm joking. I think there's a bit of luck involved. I had some unlucky experiences with, like, supervisors leaving and so on. Mm. And I know other people who've had that experience where, they've had problems with lots of changes of supervisors or something. I also had an admin person who got it in for me, so then that made it very hard to get funding for conferences and stuff. She would just stall my paperwork or lose it, or and I still to this day don't know why. And then I had this problem with this examiner who just hated my work, so that was kind of soul-destroying. But at the same time, there was some great stuff. But I've actually, just to point everyone at my blog, I've written a blog post about this. My website is Rachel Nightingale, and I wrote a blog post about doing a creative PhD. And from my experiences, what I say is go in with your eyes wide open. Understand how it works and what it's like, because for some people it might be a difficult place. I heard an academic once say, some people are just not suited to being in academia, and she was talking about basically if they're too soft, if they're sensitive and gentle and all this kind of stuff. And I took that to heart, because that's me. And I think that writers need to have a level of sensitivity and empathy about them, but academics, it's a pretty cutthroat business being an academic, so it can be an uneasy fit, and I think it's important to then do your research and find supervisors that you really get on well with. You've got no control over whether they're going to leave and go to another university or have a breakdown or whatever, but at least finding a supportive supervisor or a couple of supervisors. But also, one of the things I really recommend is, if you are doing it, create your own support group with your colleagues who are also going through the PhD, because that's what got me through when shit was going down, beat that out, was that we had formed our own support group, and we would meet regularly, and we even set up a social club so we could get funding to buy wine, and that helped a lot. I think doing your research, going into it with your eyes wide open, making sure you've got a good match with your supervisor, and making sure you set up your own supports are really important if you're not one of these people who's just going to fit in perfectly with the sort of academic environment. Yeah.
One thing that seemed really common with people that I knew who did it was a feeling of imposter syndrome, and maybe it's just good to expect that there is a bit of imposter syndrome, that you think, I'm going to look around You know, someone is going to figure out that I'm not smart enough to be here. And something else useful that somebody said to me while I was doing it was the point of a PhD is that it should push you way beyond where you're comfortable. It should be the hardest thing you've ever done. That is the point of them. And that was actually helpful to just shift my thinking and go, that's right, it's not meant to be easy. It is meant to be an intellectual endeavour that pushes me into new areas. Doing it here at Writing and Society, the support and networking with other students was fantastic. So I would agree with that too.
Just to tie that up, in terms of who shouldn't do it, I think if I had, just speaking from personal experience, I think there's, when you're writing and when you start writing, there's a whole load of stages of just doing a lot of really bad writing that you need to kind of go through before you kind of find your feet and you kind of know how to tell a story. And I think if I'd have started the PhD 10 years ago or something like that when I'd started writing, I wouldn't have got half as much out of it because I'd just be learning those sort of basic things, and that's probably best done just by writing. It depends on sort of where you are with your writing in order to get a lot out of it.
I hope you've enjoyed this discussion. If you would like to know more about the Historical Novel Society Australasia and our numerous activities to promote reading and writing historical fiction, please visit our website www.hnsa.org.au. There you'll also find full biographies of our podcast participants under the tab News and Interviews. I'm Greg Johnston, and thank you for listening to this podcast.